to another Glenn and Helen podcast. Today's topic is squarely on Helen's turf. We'll be talking about the politicization of the American Psychological Association, what it's doing to the mental health profession and their credibility, and what people should do about it.
Today we'll be talking to Dr. Nicholas Cummings, who's the co-author, along with Rogers Wright, of Destructive Trends in Mental Health, The Well-Intentioned Path to Harm. Dr. Cummings is a past president of the American Psychological Association, and he's actually the one who spearheaded this successful effort to get the APA to stop regarding homosexuality as a mental disease. And now he thinks that the APA has become so politicized that it's hurting the profession, the organization, and most importantly, the patients. We'll talk to him about his experiences, his book, and what psychologists and other Americans ought to be doing about this problem.
Dr. Nicholas Cummings is former president of the American Psychological Association, and he's the author, along with Dr. Rogers Wright, of a recent book, Destructive Trends in Mental Health, The Well-Intentioned Path to Harm. And we've got him on the phone now.
Welcome, Dr. Cummings. Thank you for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. The first question I have for you is, just looking at your book, Destructive Trends in Mental Health, the inside flap says psychology, psychiatry, and social work have been captured by an ultra-liberal agenda. Could you tell us what that means, and what damage, if any, is this ultra-liberal agenda doing to the profession of psychology?
It's undermining the very foundation of psychology and the fact that psychology is a science and a profession. And when it speaks as an organization, it should speak from evidence, from science and the profession, not out of political ideology. Unfortunately, the APA has been captured by a political ideology which doesn't permit certain kinds of research, certain kinds of discussion, because it's not politically correct. So eventually what happens is the credibility of the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatric Association is eroded.
Now, you're a past president of the APA, and what exactly has gone on? What accounts for this change since then?
Well, originally, it was enunciated in 1974, that when the APA speaks as a professional and scientific body, it speaks only from evidence. If it lacks that kind of psychological evidence, and any psychologist who's a member of the organization wants to take certain political stances, she or he is certainly able to join any activist organization out there that speaks in with the tongue they want to speak in. However, the association itself, if it speaks politically instead of scientifically, it eventually, people just see it as another activist organization out there shouting in a loud cacophony of noises.
You gave a presentation at NARTH, which is the National Association for Research and Therapy of Homosexuality, and that was in California, and you charged the APA with stifling discourse and distorting research. Could you tell us why you think this is so?
Well, for example, the APA Council of Representatives in 2004 passed the resolution that gay marriage is good for mental health.
Mm-hmm. Is there any research for that?
There is no research, but the APA claimed there was. And, of course, when push comes to shove and you ask what the research is, it's a body of research that shows that loving relationships promote mental health, that taking that and applying it to gay marriage is quite a stretch indeed, and the research was never done on gay marriage.
Well, I'm all in favor of gay marriage, but I have to say that doesn't change the science, or, you know, at least it doesn't turn non-evidence into evidence. What do you think's driving that?
You know, it's a political agenda. It's gay and lesbian lobby in the APA has made certain ways of talking politically incorrect. For example, I share with you, I am in favor of gay marriage, but the fact that I am not in favor of distorting research in order to back that position by a body of psychology makes me anathema to the people who would be politically correct on this subject.
You said that when you were writing your book, in fact, that people were so afraid of the gay lobby that a lot of people wouldn't help you. Is that right?
We had several excellent authors who had excellent chapters to contribute who withdrew them because they were threatened with loss of tenure, loss of promotion, loss of collegiality. So they just withdrew.
It's almost like McCarthyism.
Well, yes, especially this was true among younger psychologists who were not as well established as perhaps some of us are, and were subject to, what can I say, retaliation.
Yes, I saw some of that even in graduate school, but it happened to be with a male. There was a male psychology student who said something politically incorrect about African Americans, and the next thing I knew, the guy was gone from our program. And when I asked about it, people just said, "Well, he said something that people that the professors didn't like, which was, I think, having to do with Jensen's research on intelligence." But I thought that was a little bit strong to kick somebody out of a program for having a politically incorrect view.
Well, unfortunately, it's probably happened more than once.
Yes. That brings me to another question. Where have all the men in psychology gone? The field of psychology is now 67% women.
Well, men aren't going into psychology anymore. There are, because psychology in a large sense is declining, doctoral psychology right now, according to government statistics that just recently were published in the fall of last year, is the lowest paid doctoral profession in healthcare.
Yeah, I believe that.
And consequently, men who are still, you know, in spite of years of feminism and so forth, men are still essentially more oriented toward careers, will gravitate away from psychology into more lucrative and more, productive kinds of endeavors.
But you also mentioned that you yourself were subject to reverse discrimination at an actual APA meeting for being a white, straight male. Can you tell us about that?
Well, this was in a meeting called by the then current APA president to discuss the future of psychology. And believe it or not, a few years ago, this was quite a large interest in the APA because psychology seemed to be declining. So during this meeting, there was a woman psychologist who said something. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I started to agree with her. And before I could open my mouth, she said, this is in a public meeting with maybe 70 or 80 people in attendance, said, I don't know what you're going to say, but there isn't anything you can say that you and I would agree on because you are a white male and I am a lesbian.
And wasn't the same female apparently abusing her clients?
Well, yes, this was the same woman that a few years later was accused of having a dual relationship with a female client.
Uh-huh, and she was getting awards from the APA, apparently.
She has since received awards from the APA, in spite of the fact that she had to forfeit her license.
It sounds like an organization that's got a lot of deep difficulties. Do you think there's any hope for the APA?
I often wonder. The APA at one time was a very, very staid organization. It changed over the years. Whether it can change back, I was very, very gratified by the fact that so many psychologists and so many prominent psychologists, including several APA past presidents, have come out in favor of our book, have come out in favor of an open discussion with the APA on changing direction. And at the next APA convention, which takes place in August in New Orleans, there is an open meeting scheduled entitled The Psychology Due for Reform. Hmm. I will be participating in that panel.
Well, I hope they'll let you talk, even though you're a straight white male.
Yeah, you mentioned there was another meeting you're supposed to go to. I guess that's for North. And you said there was a lobby that was trying to lobby that you couldn't speak there. What's that about?
I'm scheduled to speak in at the Archives of Psychology in Akron.
Okay, something different.
In April. And there was on the listserv circulated derogatory comments about me, and that I was no longer an icon of psychology, and that people should be discouraged from going to hear me.
Mm-hmm. And why was that? I mean, any actual evidence or?
Well, as I said, because I took a stand that the APA should not promote a political resolution claiming it has scientific evidence. And I did that at NARTH. Even though I am in favor of gay marriage, I'm now accused of being homophobic.
Mm-hmm. And what's that about? I mean, people get on my website and they accuse me of being a conservative bigot. If I even bring up the fact that the APA needs to look into research about reparative therapy, what's that about? I mean, it seems like people just try to shut down communication. Isn't that a kind of cultural fascism?
It is a kind of cultural fascism. A couple of years ago, there was an attempt in the Council of Representatives of the APA to make reparative therapy unethical. Now, reparative therapy purports to take people who are having trouble being homosexuals, who want to change and become straight, that it treats them and purports to have a degree of success. The research on how successful it is mixed. Some show it's pretty good, some show it isn't helpful at all. However, the APA came within two votes of banning it as unethical, and which would make immediately the patient would lose the ability to choose the kind of treatment he or she would want.
So in other words, if a therapy client came to my office, in the course of talking to them, they told me they were had homosexual feelings and wanted to change those, the APA would say that ethically I could not do that.
Correct.
And I'm supposed to tell them only about the gay lifestyle, that that's positive, and that they should stay that way. Am I reading?
That's the implication, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Even if the person themselves wanted to change.
Right. Now, the interesting thing at NARTH, when Dr. Wright and I were asked to share a keynote address, at no time, even though we made it very clear at the outset that we had certain disagreements with NARTH, for example, both Dr. Wright and I are pro-choice, mm-hmm. and NARTH is quite strongly pro-life, although we feel that there should be some restrictions on choice, that the NARTH never once attempted to tell us what to say or what not to say. They gave us free rein. They said, you can say anything you want.
Well, puts a leg up on the APA.
Well, I wish the APA would follow that example.
Mm-hmm. Do people ever say about your book that it's just some kind of right-wing propaganda, or it's a conservative backlash?
Oh, yes. In fact, the information officer of the APA, when it first came out, a year ago this month, called it a right-wing manifesto.
But you're not even a conservative. Aren't you a liberal?
Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. I have been a liberal activist all my life.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I was president of the APA, I appointed the first gay and lesbian task force in American psychology.
Well, that's kind of a switch for the APA. I mean, it was only about 30 years ago that they were calling homosexuality a mental disorder that needed to be treated. So I guess it's a case of often wrong but never in doubt, or?
Well, things have changed, believe it or not. In the 70s, I was the one, as a member of the Council of Representatives, before I had been elected president, that introduced the successful resolution that being a homosexual was not a disease.
And how did they decide to change that? In 1973, that was changed in the DSM. And for people out there who don't know, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual is the book used by psychiatrists and psychologists to diagnose mental disorders. How did that change? And were you said you were an advocate in that change.
Well, the change, of course, came through the American Psychiatric Association, which publishes the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And the leadership of the American Psychiatric Association was so deadlocked that they actually put the matter to a vote of the membership, and it is probably the only instance I can think of in all of the history of medicine where a diagnosis was decided by vote instead of by evidence.
So that's how they decided, just by vote.
It was decided by vote of the membership.
Okay, no published studies or looking into any research or anything?
No.
The other question I have is, why does the APA, it seems to me, they never publish any studies on the traits of liberals, and they only focus on the negative traits of conservatives. For example, there's a study, Political Conservatism as Socially Motivated Cognition. Why is that? Why do they not look into the traits of liberals, or at least the negative traits?
Because the APA considers liberalism
the norm,
healthy and normal, or conservatism as some kind of an aberration.
Mm-hmm. And have you read that study?
I've read a variety of studies. There have been a number over the years. The recent, most recent one a year or two ago was at the University of California at Berkeley, which concluded that Hitler, Joseph Stalin, and Ronald Reagan were all of the same conservative ilk, which blows anyone's mind.
Mm-hmm. I think that was part of this study on political conservatism as socially motivated cognition. And it seemed to me they did what's called a meta-analysis. In other words, they just looked at a number of articles and took out the most negative traits they could find on conservatives and didn't do the same with liberals. I mean, that was my take. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, you're absolutely right. There's an absolute paucity. In fact, I can't even think of one right now.
I can think of one. I found a really good study. It was actually in a book called The Roots of Radicalism, where a group of psychologists took the TAT cards and gave them to radical leftists and found very negative traits in liberals. But that study was never used and never even mentioned in any of the psychological research.
Well, that study would not be politically correct.
Well, I guess not. Well, what do those of us with differing viewpoints? I'm not a conservative, by the way. I actually used to be a Democrat, and now I'm a libertarian, more or less.
Uh-huh.
But what do we do? Say we've got differing viewpoints from the APA, and I'm a member of the APA. What should we do?
Well, I think that there is a very, very disaffected majority within the APA that has just given up, that they can't have any effect on the organization, and I think they should start speaking up.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully the forum we're going to have in New Orleans will spark some of that. But there is, you know, among psychologists today, there's a way of showing your disaffection with the organization by walking with your feet. They just drop out of the APA.
Well, I'd like to drop out, but what do you do if you're a forensic psychologist and you go to court and one of the first questions they ask you is, are you in the APA? I mean, wouldn't kind of looks bad if you say, well, no, and have to qualify it with, well, I guess you could just say politically, I don't agree with them, so I had to drop out.
Well, yes, but what effect will that have on the jury?
Well, probably none. They might be positive towards me. I might win the case.
Well, just explain, the APA thinks that a majority of Americans would vote for Hitler, apparently. Well, it does sort of make me wonder. I mean, the APA is very much like a lot of professional associations. I mean, you see the same thing, for example, with the American Bar Association. It seems to have drifted out of touch with its members and really be running more in the service of the staff and a fairly small group of leadership. That's hard to turn around, but it's kind of entrenched, again, like the Bar Association, in a lot of legal ways. Should people be approaching state legislators or whatever and suggesting that the APA not have the role of a detached professional organization, given that it's not?
Well, I think that's going to happen. And a colleague of mine about 4 or 5 years ago did a statistical study. We went back into the records and went back the last 20 years and found that there was essentially a group of 180 psychologists who rotated through all of the offices, the council, the division leadership, so that essentially the organization was reflecting under 200 members.
Wow. So as a member, I mean, do you recommend that I write my legislator? Or, you know, I've written to the APA, but, you know, I don't know how much good that really does.
It they wouldn't even pay attention to it.
I know. I got a basic form letter back. Dear Dr. Smith, thank you very much for your comment.
Yes.
So, so the way to speak is maybe to, through the legislature.
Yes. And I think that that opposition seems to be growing. I keep hearing from people saying things may be turning.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know here in the state of Tennessee, the ethics guidelines of the APA are incorporated into the bylaws of our licensing board. So if they put something in there, for example, making it unethical to do any type of reparative therapy, that would mean that ethically or actually you could have your license taken for that, possibly. Is that...
That's correct. The APA Code of Ethics has been incorporated in most state licensing laws.
I think most psychologists don't even realize that. When I talk to them, they really have no clue.
Yeah, they look at the ethics code and say, well, there are a lot of silly things
yes.
in there, and I don't have to worry about
That's
it.
That's exactly yet. Right. I've talked to several of them. They just say, well, it doesn't matter. It's not my, you know, I'll just do what I want to do. But they don't realize that somebody can actually, the ethics boards are looking at that, and if somebody wants to make a stink about it, they can.
Absolutely.
One last question. I know Senator Bill Frist, we had him on a recent podcast. He read your book and wrote you saying that he was making it mandatory reading for his staff. Do you think?
Yes, I received a very, very wonderful personal letter from Senator Frist thanking me for sending him a copy of the book, saying that as a physician, he found it very enlightening. He understands more about psychology than he had before, and he was passing it on the staff as a must read.
Do you think your book will influence policies in mental health at all?
Well, it's an uphill fight, but I hope so.
It's really striking to me the way so many of these organizations do drift out of touch. And I you know, as you guys were discussing earlier, I think even a lot of people in the professions don't realize that many states have basically outsourced a lot of their regulation of these professions to these associations, which are really run by a relatively small number of people who aren't really elected by anyone in any meaningful sense. And I wonder if you think there's going to be a more general backlash in that direction.
I think there will be. It may take time. These kinds of things, you see the seeds of it now. People are disaffected, and they are starting to speak up. And fortunately, our book has given a lot of people the courage to say, you know, I've been thinking about all of those things for years, and by gosh, that book says what I feel, and I'm going to speak up.
Well, I noticed that, you know, when I was a kid, I remember that the psychological and psychiatric professions had a lot of authority and prestige. And it seems to me like they have a lot less now. And as you point out, their membership is declining a lot, which makes me wonder if there's a connection. And if you think maybe this political stuff is sort of self-limiting because it's driving the prestige of the profession down. Or do they care enough?
Well, I think they care, but I think they're blind to what they're doing. They think they're doing what is right. And the American people can only take so much of divergence from where they are and where the APA is. And what bothers me is that the profession of psychology that is founded on the understanding of people is so out of touch with the people of the United States.
That's a great point to end on.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
Well, that was interesting, and it sounds like the APA is just yet another big institution in need of reform.
That's why I want people to read Dr. Cummings' book, Destructive Trends in Mental Health. A lot of people, even a lot of psychologists, don't realize just how out of touch the APA has become. I'm hoping that word will spread and help psychologists reclaim our profession from the people who have politicized it.
Well, you know, a lot of professions have been politicized over the last couple of decades, and we've certainly seen that problem with the American Bar Association, which... I'm associated with, but I think that's what happens if you don't pay attention to these things. The people who do pay attention tend to take them over, and they're usually the people with some kind of an agenda.
So people pay attention.
We hope you paid attention to this podcast anyway and that you liked it. We'll be back again whenever we get the chance. You can check for podcast updates at our blogs, instapundit.com or drhelen.blogspot.com, or you can subscribe via iTunes. We like that. And then you'll get it automatically. There's also a podcast archive and
lo-fi versions for dial-up users, all at our sites. Until next time, we look forward to seeing you on the internet.
Talk to you next time.
The Glenn and Helen podcasts are produced by Glenn Reynolds and Helen Smith. Show notes, music information, and more are available at instapundit.com.